Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Again, this is the El Arpa podcast, and joining me in studio is Mary. Que quia viltu? Consitatu? How are you?
Como?
Fantastic. So we are now officially in week two of the course. This is Thursday. You're listening to this on Friday at the earliest, because it's going up tomorrow. So we're almost in week three of the course. We are officially at the halfway point. This is a four-week course. Can you fill us in? Isn't it?
Oh, I thought you said last week it was six.
Oh, yeah?
I thought it was four, and then you convinced me it was six.
Compromise. It's a five-week course. So potentially not, we are at the halfway point. But please do fill us in loudly about the course, the progress we've made on this course, of course.
Well, we've learned lots of things, from just the usual courtesies to... the house, for example, and its different parts. Talking about where you come from versus where you live, if it's different. You can ask me to say it, aren't you?
No, but you've made a startling discovery that the Oscar, the AI, is actually not an AI bot. It's a real person pretending to be a bot in what could potentially have been a cost-saving measure by the university to suggest they had this technology, but in reality...
Do you really think it was a bot?
Yeah, of course it did. They said it was a bot, so...
Yeah, but those are the ones that reply to questions in a very stupid way. Like, you know, on the website, like, you put a question and then it just throws...
John Oliver actually has a great bit about this in his latest episode of Last Week Tonight. Have you seen that particular one?
I think so.
About automated robocalls?
Yes, I have.
So you've seen the part where the journalist is like, can you say I'm not a robot?
Yes.
Of course I'm a real person. I get that, but say the words, I'm not a robot. Of course I'm a real person. So how it's sophisticated, to be fair, but obviously not good enough to fool a real human. But yeah, so I assume that these people would be bots.
Hmm.
But they're not. So you sniff that out, Mary Hound.
I don't know. I mean, very well. I might be wrong. I just got the impression that because how would it work? Because, you know, in the final video every week, they answer some questions, and then the robot, that is just like a video of a robot, had the same voice as the guy from the video.
So yeah, that
in my humble opinion.
So dos, I guess dos is uno, indo. I can't remember.
Cahar or something like
that. Cahar. That's Cahar. It. So, yeah. Dos agus dos.
Yeah.
No, that's Spanish.
Dos agus dos.
Do agus do. Equals.
Equals.
Cahar. So, anyway.
Whatever. Actually, the numbers are there as well.
I've skipped that. I went straight to the Logonymica, which is the place names. So, funnily enough, Limerick is undetermined. Nobody knows what the name could be, but there's also a possible name, which was like a negative one.
Barren land,
yeah. Mm. So I guess Limerick has always been cursed, even going back to a long, long time ago.
Poor Limerick.
Cork is the rebel county. Well, most Irish people will know that. Clare, I never knew, was the garden county, which in America is a garden state, which I believe is California, but it doesn't really matter.
It's probably for the tourist leaflets.
Well, yeah, all that stuff. Well, Limerick is technically the gateway to the Southwest, because it's the first place you go to so you can get to the Southwest.
That's the definition of a gate.
Or a gateway. But it's the course is going really well. It's funny because you can see the comments from other people. There's a guy from Jakarta, Indonesia, who has said that there's actually because of the Irish Embassy, Sunday, the Sunday, March 17th, is of course St. Patrick's Day. He said there's going to be a parade there, which we don't have in Madrid. And we were talking midweek about the Irish Embassy as well, how they're not very active. I have to say, the plans for this year's St. Patrick's Day are pretty meager, pretty poor. There's a Pope quiz, and that's it. well, there's one performance from Irish Treble who we've made a video with before. But you have to pay to get into that. So, I mean, we were saying that we don't know what the French do for Bastille Day, but we imagine there's like a lot of activities.
Yeah.
In terms of like 4th of July and things like that and Thanksgiving, I know the American Embassy have a party and the Irish Embassy probably has a party because I know they've done that in the past. But I'm not sure if the Americans organize cultural events, but I think the French are probably active.
Yeah, of course.
And it's kind of disappointing because I think what we are good at, in a ironic sense, I'm criticizing this, is that we're good at paddy whackery, which is selling a plastic version of the country, leprechauns and fields of gold and rainbows to primarily American tourists, but, you know, even Spanish people lap that shite up, basically, you know. We have a rich culture that, you know, we're not even exploiting. So, and then if you contact the embassy, they're not very responsive. So I don't know if they're understaffed, inundated with consular activity. Someone's had a car accident and they have to perform the last rites and stamp their passport or whatever that would entail. But yeah, it's kind of disappointing. So I think, you know, and also I was going to be doing a talk at a university. Actually, I haven't told you this, so you're finding this out on the podcast. Originally, it was supposed to be...
You live in
a country? No, it's supposed to be... we could do a phone-in for the podcast. Originally, I was going to be doing a talk in a university, in a communications university, in May. Then it moved to March to coincide with St. Patrick's Day. And now it's been moved again to next autumn. But I was going to be doing like an unofficial St. Patrick's Day event. I was going to focus on him as a communicator because it's a communications university. Mm-hmm. He, of course, was a great communicator in the idea of he explained Christianity through parable and story. And, of course, the treble or the shamrock would be how he explained the division of Christ, the Holy Trinity. But of course, then we also know from his confessions, he was obligated to write that, and in that he betrayed a very human insecurity as well. So I think there was probably a lot of soil to be tilled or furrowed or ploughed with that kind of idea. I think it could have been an interesting talk, which, all going well, we'll do that in the autumn. And they have a radio station which has been newly released or launched, and apparently our podcast could potentially become part of their network, which is not anything to be sniffed at if it does happen. But we were going back to the course as well. So I actually left a comment to that effect underneath the Jakarta guy's post. Also, a couple of ones caught my attention. One comment was about how the dog in the story of Satanta died, and she said, "I can't support a story where an animal dies." And I wrote a comment. I don't normally do this, but I thought, why not? It's an Irish... I don't actually comment online because, A, I just don't. And but this time I just did. Yeah, but it was polite. You were there to police me.
Not even on British coaches.
That's a different thing. That's when... I'll talk about that in a second.
Okay.
British
coaches abroad.
Yeah, well, and then that got changed to Irish coaches abroad because another person got stolen or robbed of their identity. But speaking of which, as an aside, there's going to be the first prosecution in Northern Ireland for a British soldier who's involved in Bloody Sunday. So it's been a long process for those families. And I know this is kind of like in the middle of this huge thing about the Irish thing, but since you mentioned Northern Ireland, I said I'd bring it up. And it is a very positive development, and I'm very, very happy things like this are finally happening. Mm. I think this soldier F, as he's been dubbed, is going to be protected to the hilt. Obviously, the British government are paying for his expenses as well, but the fact that it's coming to a trial is very, very positive. Mm. So anyway, back to the joviality of the Irish platform. So the comment I left was actually pretty measured. It was just like, look, in this story, the idea is that the dog being killed is a sad thing. So that's why he could call him, well, at this time, Satanta, had to pay his debt. And the moral of the story is you have to pay your debts in society. So, you know, objectively, the dog being killed is a sad thing. So it's not like some kind of animal rights issue, really. Yeah, you know what I mean? And anyway, sure. It's a mythological story. Yeah. I mean, Cuchulainn goes on to kill his best friend, like, half naked in a river. And I don't think people believe in a comment going, oh, why did he kill his best friend? But also as well, there's another comment. I didn't respond. There's a couple of other comments, but one I didn't respond to was about, like, is Cuchulainn actually Satanta? And then I think it was International Women's Day, and someone just wrote a list of female warriors underneath it. Now, of course, Ireland has a great tradition of that. It was only when the Catholic Church came in and Christianity came in that the equality between the genders was kind of rolled back, because in Celtic society there was actually a lot of equality between the sexes. But it just like, I understand why she was doing it, but it was just the wrong place and kind of misdirected advocacy, I would say, you know. But those are only minor things. I think overall the community vibe is very positive and we've been learning a lot. It's really amazing. And speaking of languages, you're going to be telling us in part two about which language?
Basque.
Yes, you will. I look forward to that, because I feel like I've been talking a lot again. This will be a great opportunity for you to voice your voice.
Concerns.
in part two. So I think we've covered a lot there. So yeah, we'll just jump to part two and we'll join you very, very soon. /momentarily. Part two of the show, and this is the part where we're going to learn a little bit about the Basque language and why for centuries it remained unwritten, which is a bit of an anomaly, I think, for most languages. And here to explain it to us is noted philologist, language expert. Sorry, remind me again, your PhD is in languages, right?
No, it's not in languages.
What is it in?
In archaeology.
Ah, okay. So, well, you can feel free to disregard the second part and go to part three if you wish. Just fast forward. Most podcast styles have like a 5 or 10 second thing you can skip. But for those that do stay, I'm sure you're in for a treat. So this is a vast period of time. Big topic. So where do you want to place us, the listener, in this story? And we can expand from there.
Well, I think we can start from the fact that most people, and especially most Spanish people, know nothing at all about the Basque language or Basque literature. And you do learn a little bit at school, not of the language, of course, but you learn a little bit about the history. But it's mostly like explaining the development of Spanish from Latin, and then some other like Romance language?
Romantic languages.
Mm-hmm. And then obviously Basque is not one of them. But well, it's like a couple of things get mentioned, but not very much at all. So first of all, I think it's a bit of a shock, because when I started reading about it, I realized I had no idea. And I don't know, I kind of assumed that there was a whole history of literature that just was like unbeknown to me. And then I started discovering all these things, mainly to do with the lack of literature, which is quite peculiar. And well, it all started there.
Okay, so first off the bat as well, is Basque a controversial language in the same way Catalan is? Or I guess I should say, has it been politicized as much as Catalan? I mean, do kids learn Basque in school today? And are people in Madrid a bit suspicious of it in the same way people learning Catalan in schools there provokes disquiet in places like Madrid?
Yes, and definitely I would say that. Obviously, there's nowhere near the same amount of people that speak Basque on a daily basis as there is Catalan. or as they are Catalan, they basically, well, I would say, like, even when Catalan people are speaking Catalan in Madrid, you already get, like, people just giving them funny looks and stuff like that.
Speaking Catalan in Madrid.
Yeah, when they're speaking Catalan in Madrid, like, people sort of, like, I don't know, give them, like, a funny look.
Yeah, there's also a situation as well, if you try and speak, I've heard stories, I've always been treated very well in Catalonia, but if you speak Spanish to them, very often they won't respond, or they'll respond in Catalan. I've heard this happen, not in a Basque or Catalan speaking area, but maybe, what are the other languages in Spain, regional ones?
Well, Galician?
Galician, it could have been Galician, I don't know. One of my students, the girl in the supermarket, wouldn't speak Spanish to her, and so she just left the food in the trolley and just walked out of the supermarket. But I heard there's a trick to overcome that, is that what you have to do is, like, not intentionally understand the money, how much you owe them, and then when money's involved, they'll find the language to tell you how much you owe them, so you'll kind of break down their resistance when it comes to not speaking Spanish to you. But, you know, these are anecdotal stories. But also, apart from the fact that they mightn't like you speaking Spanish to them, and they might respond in Catalan or otherwise, I've also heard there's a culture there that if you have a business, you know, maybe it's, you've offices all over Spain, if you go to Catalonia for a meeting, they kind of sneer at you for being Spanish. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but that is the image that's out there. So we'll just put that out there, whether it's true or not. But I get the sense that it's not the same for Basque people, that if you're from Madrid and you have an office in Bilbao, you go there, you're not the fool from Madrid, you know, and if you speak Spanish to them, it's not going to be an issue, maybe. I don't know if that's correct or...
Yeah, but the thing is, like, for me, it's a two-way thing from a certain amount of people. So saying something like that is like saying, well, people in Madrid, they look at them suspiciously, way as some people do.
Yeah.
Which is really stupid. And then some people have an issue with Catalan people in general. You know what I mean? And equally with Basque people in general. So, you know, there's a thing, like, obviously, when you live here, but you're not from here, which is a lot of people.
Well, Madrid is famous for being this open city where nobody is from Madrid, no?
Yeah, but I mean, that I think that causes that if you're from elsewhere, then... I'm going to get slated for all this. But is from my point of view, you know, personally, I have no issue at all. And in fact, I really enjoy when I hear people speaking, especially Catalan or Galician, because I can understand. Obviously, with Basque, you cannot understand at all. So, but there, for me, it's not an issue of, like, you know, I don't understand what they're saying, they must be plotting something. It's just that I can't exercise, you know, what I like doing of comparing languages.
Yeah.
So that's the only frustration for me. But there are many other people that, yeah, feel threatened. So, I mean, the thing, like, of saying that people sneered if you speak in Spanish when you're in Catalonia or whatever like that, but it's also the same in Madrid.
Yes, and to kind of go back into the past with the Basque language, there's also a very interesting reason for why it remained unwritten for a very long time, that it was seen as a bulwark against a rising tide of modernity. And maybe you can explain a little bit more about that.
Yeah. Well, recently there has been some studies published by some Basque philologists or...
Oh, working in the same field as you.
Yes. And there are two in particular who, well... Recently, I'm talking, you know, the 90s probably, where they put forward a theory which said that most likely the reason why Basque had been kind of, because, okay, this is important to say before I explain, which is that the priests or the literature is dominated by... up until the 18th and late 18th century is dominated by priests. Okay, so everything that you get that gets written down even if it's okay, some of them are stories or poems or whatever, but it always comes from the church. And also the priests are famous for like having a very important role in the Basque Country, right? And in this case, for example, they use them in the
sorry, to explain that laughing, I'm just sitting very awkwardly, so
you look like you're falling asleep. It does in a way there. So basically the theory says that probably the priests kind of like monopolized this language because it was a way of, this was the language of like the countryside. And obviously in the Basque Country, I mean, it's the border with France, the Pyrenees, and there's a huge amount of countryside and people lived in like valleys, and there are a lot of mountains separating them, and so obviously because the valleys, and they by doing that they basically guaranteed by supporting the language of the villagers that they could control the influx of ideas, you know, and that all the ideas that were coming, especially from France, for example, would not penetrate the population.
Okay.
So it is quite an interesting, this is like the theories that they put forward, and I think that makes sense. I can see through history how that's worked, and I think it's very peculiar because it's the opposite to what usually happens with the vernacular language. You know, vernacular languages are like normally used to express identity and
in an unofficial way, no?
In an unofficial way, yeah. But yeah, normally against another power. In this case, this is what happens in the 20th century, like after the Basque Nationalist Party is founded at the beginning of the 20th century. But it's not what happens before. So it's kind of like, it sort of like skips them. Do you know the nationalist romantic movements of the 19th century?
Okay, so I have two questions. I'll start with the first one. It's always a good place to start. The Basque Country borders France, no?
Yes.
For example, good.
That's a good start, Olya.
That was I was going out on a limb there. No, so I mean, I imagine there's contact between those two areas, even though you had remote places in the Spanish parts of the Basque Country, if that makes mm-hmm. sense. And on the French side of the border, you'd Basque speaking people there as well. So,
yeah.
Maybe you haven't come across this in the literature or your research, but how didn't the ideas there from the French side filter over to the Spanish side? Maybe the French church were fulfilling the same function. The French church was blocking the modernist ideas in French for the Basque speaking people in the French side of the border, maybe something similar to that, or I don't know, how do you explain that these things were coming from the French language and from France, and they didn't have much of an impact in the Basque Country on the Spanish side of the border? I don't know if that makes sense.
Yes, it does make sense, but it's because the kind of like the Basque are a nation, let's say, so like part of it is in Spain and part of it is in France, but as an entity it's very peculiar because there are certain periods in history in which they are even kind of like teaming up and having their own discussions or their own conversation about what's happening between France and Spain. Obviously, like France and Spain are historical enemies, and you know there are big relationships, but also like lots of political, you know, going backwards and forwards, and at one point they are kind of like the middle people, you know, between France and Spain, and both of them they're kind of like the only ones that understand each other. You know, because okay. they use the same language.
So rather than being this brokering agent, they're just caught in the middle, more or less. They're not empowered by this mutual understanding.
Well, I think they are, because if you think about it, like both of them are part of two countries, and they can vouch for those two countries in whichever way they want with each other.
So you know what I mean? Would someone from the Basque Country be able to influence official Spanish policy? Then I don't know if you've come across this either, but so because they had this mutual understanding, they would be deferred to or consulted when it came to.
It's because it's not necessarily because of that, but this would be very long to explain. But basically, it's because.
We have time.
No, but historically, I mean, this is all completely embedded into the history of Spain, and you. It's impossible to understand it without like a modern history understanding.
Okay.
Basically, it's to do with the fact that you have a very powerful kingdom there, which is the Navarra Kingdom, and they even to this date, they have what is called like los fueros. I think you can say fuera law, no? It's kind of like a special privileges, like they have a special relation that they kind of like have their own rules. It's kind of like medieval kind of agreements that they were allowed to keep throughout the centuries. Even now, they have like their own kind of like separate law. Obviously, every community in Spain has a different, their own like local law, but they kind of like their law even supersedes the national law. You know, it's a very specific circumstance for Navarra in particular. And obviously the Basque Country, depending on the moment of history, it's kind of like part of the same kingdom. I mean, the kingdom is smaller or bigger depending on the moment, and it takes over part of France depending on the moment as well. So at a point when like Navarra is kind of like in between, then of course it's very powerful because it's, well, both countries are interested in like having good relationships with it.
Okay, that sounds like it.
In a nutshell.
Yeah.
Because I'm an ancient historian, not a modern historian, and probably people are thinking this is very simplistic. But of course, you know, because you've studied modern history, that like European modern history is super complicated to
condense.
Explain and how like the borders move all the time and.
Actually, that's something I we should have mentioned in part one about that Dutch historian, speaking of historians, who advocated for universal basic income. Well, that can wait for another week. But also, it seems like there's a lot of things there that we could explore in more detail in another podcast as well. Fascinating stuff. But also what I want to say is, my second question is that the Catholic Church as a structure, I'm not sure how it works. Obviously, it's divided into different cities and towns. You have parishes and local churches. But, you know, I guess from what you've said, the Basque priests would have had a significant degree of autonomy from the center of the Catholic power, which would have been in Madrid or Valladolid or Salamanca, for example. So do you know why, or was there any indication as to why there's this vacuum as well? So you have a political vacuum, but also this religious authority vacuum. Like, what happened there to allow that to flourish?
Well, I'm assuming you mean like lack of presence from the central government.
In a sense, I do mean that because, but then again, maybe my question is invalid because the idea is like that. The church was a conservative institution set against modern ideas, which I guess even the church in Madrid was like that as well, no?
Yeah, so, of course.
Okay.
Yes.
So.
It's a vacuum question.
So, it bears asking, I guess, and we've discovered the answer in the question. But so we've established one of the reasons why it remained unwritten for such a long time. You've also explored this area in some significant detail. So what other things can you tell us about the state of the Basque language, why it remained unwritten for such a long time, these kind of things?
Well, the thing of why it remains unwritten, I think it's I find it unbelievable. I'm very hard to justify. I mean, I find it hard to believe. And the most peculiar thing is that There is an awful amount of documents that supports the knowledge that there were people, many areas only spoke Basque, and this is all because in the texts, in the documents, they tell us about how basically there were scribes that had to go over and that knew both languages, because if they had to do anything official to do, anything to do with a central power or whatever, even though for a long period this is not quite like that, and we have to go back to the issue of the kingdoms and all this. But in modern history, when they're doing any sort of official thing, they're being translated. So there are documents that tell us that, you know, these people went, and because this person only spoke Basque. And that gets mentioned a lot, which is a very strange thing, bearing in mind that then the documents written in the language are very scarce. And as I was saying before, are limited to, for a very long time, to religious texts or religious translations, poetry, but within like the religious sphere, that sort of thing, translations from Latin.
Okay.
The first ever written documents in Latin are annotations, sorry, in Latin, in Basque, are annotations on Latin texts on the sides of religious texts.
Okay, and is there a sense as well that by contrast, the oral tradition in the Basque country was very vibrant and very rich? For example, we both listened to a podcast about Peg Sayers, this Irish woman who wrote down her story, of living on the island of Ireland. But, you know, a lot of people in Ireland at the time also wouldn't be writing and would be still fully immersed in the oral tradition, and their form of entertainment would be telling stories, and through those stories they would learn the moral codes of their particular society, which is also against this kind of authority, which at the time was Ireland under occupation as well. So my question is, I mean, in Ireland's, you know, a very strong oral tradition, I can only imagine that in the Basque Country it was even stronger, or would that be an incorrect assumption to make?
I must admit I haven't explored that very much, because my starting point was trying to find out about the literature and like written literature. So I haven't got to the stage of actually seeing what was replacing written production, because obviously we know from the documents that they were communicating in that language, and primarily in that language, and that was respected because of the fact that even like officials are sent over for the purposes of translation, even though slowly they keep on trying to impose Castilian, but up to a point, because in reality it's not very imposing, since they keep on trying, it depends on the area, but they keep on trying to maintain these scribes for a couple of centuries. So I would assume like oral tradition is very strong. Obviously I know that, for example, they have their own like myths in a similar way to the ones that we were their own legends that we were talking about, of like the origin of the world, or you know things like that. So,
and very close to Galicia as well, which would be very strong in the mythological departments as well. You mentioned the word scribes. Excuse me. Scribes. Now, you've studied Egyptian history, just to confirm that you're not a linguist, but an archaeologist.
Or an expert on Basque literature.
Scribes, as you mentioned in a previous podcast, were obviously very valued, had a huge position in society. I know it's a bit of a stretch, but do you see any kind of parallels where these scribes were kind of not, obviously, you know, semi-kings or rock stars, but you know, were a little bit above everybody else because they had this skill that wasn't widespread across the general populace?
No, I wouldn't think that at all. I think they were just like civil servants. And in the end, they're seen as a nuisance because basically they are just making it harder for everything to be homogenous, you know? So,
okay, well, that's one question that doesn't make sense then. So you tell me, am I joking? But you can tell us the final, or what else is left in your research about this? Or is that everything?
Well, later on, when not only I think it's very interesting because, for example, the first the first woman to specifically to write in Basque, or that we know that wrote in Basque. This in the I believe it's at the beginning of the 19th century, although it might be 18th century. Right now, I don't remember. I think it's 19th century. But she actually wrote some, and it's interesting because of what she wrote, because it's the first time that that kind of literature gets written, right? So what she actually wrote was a translation of Aesop's fables.
Yeah, Aesop's fables. Yes.
Yeah. Aesop's. That's it. And I said it in Latin. Sorry. And it's quite peculiar
because wasn't that originally written in Greek?
Well, but this is like the Latin name, okay? Aesop's. Okay, so she translates them from Latin into Basque. So it's very interesting because a lot of the texts that get written in Basque are translations from Latin. You know what I mean? So I think that's interesting because, and I think there would be like books and books to write about that in Ireland as well. You know, this fact that they are basically taking interested in this like classical literature, and then what she does is like translate these fables into Basque and add some more of her own accord, just new ones that she writes. So that's like quite fascinating, I think, because that's kind of like the first sort of document that to me that I could find that wasn't religious. All, but it's still to do with, you know, it's still within like the moral realm, and it's still to do with teachings, like
Well, I guess maybe there could, for me to hear that isn't so surprising. I think something that is there's no wrong answers here. Across Europe at this time, you do have this obviously fascination with Latin. It is the language of the academic elite. But also as well, it just seems everybody is just obsessed with a certain moment in time, and these kind of Greek and Roman texts were canon. They were you had to learn. It was just like this and nothing else. While now we would dip in and out of different eras, so it's kind of this conformity with the general European trend being translated into Basque. I don't know, is the intriguing part maybe?
But I think for me, The interesting thing here is that there's a contrast between that. Of course, what you're saying is a trend, but we are also saying that this language in particular is being used, or the main purpose is to, you know, stay away from ideas that are revolutionary ideas or whatever. Okay. And it might seem to you that Latin ideas are nothing to do with revolutionary, but at the end of the day, they are, because it's a continuation, because Latin evolves into Castilian, and also the other languages, Galician and Catalan. There's a separation there, and then that's, you know, that continues into modern history.
But is it, I mean, is Latin revolutionary? Because I know it is the root of the languages that contain the dangerous ideas, but in a way, this, I still, and maybe I'm wrong, I still see them as being blanketed, even by these, because they're learning these ancient texts that, in a way, you know, can still tell us things about ourselves today. They carry timeless messages, but also in a way, they're just ancient texts that have lost maybe political bite or relevance, while I don't know what would be politically explosive at that time, but like something like Voltaire, or written in French, you know, printed in underground presses, these kind of texts which would have gone around Europe, written by English writers, French writers, you know, those would have been the ones that have been suppressed. And while if someone's reading the Odyssey or the Aeneid or Ace of Fables, they're not going to be inculcated with a modernist idea that could tear down the fabric of their rural and Catholic life. I don't know if that's, again, if I'm wrong in thinking that. Maybe reading Latin and knowing that was also explosive. Maybe it's explosive by virtue of the fact that having that knowledge was wrong, because they want, like, the church and the powers that be didn't really want them to have any knowledge, because, you know, any knowledge potentially could lessen their power of whatever description, perhaps. I don't know how to interpret that, but...
No, I think both things that we mentioned are important to evaluate. I couldn't tell you whether it's one or the other. What you're saying is definitely true, and I think there's also an element to consider in what I was saying because of that political element of the church and in the area. And also, at the end of the day, to me, I find it extremely strange that there wouldn't be that their own production, you know, their own literary production in that language. That's what I find it very difficult to believe. So whether it's been lost or, you know, whether it was destroyed, I have no idea. But this is something that I would like to know more about. But I have gone through a few, not that there's that much written about it, but I've gone through a few books on like comparative history of literature and things like that by Basque writers. And none of them... I mean, all of them mention pretty much the same people that I haven't mentioned all of them, but the same history that I was talking about, which completely misses out on kind of like novels or things like that until much later.
And in modern times, are there noteworthy Basque writers either in Spanish, which I'm sure there must be, but also in the Basque language? Are there novels that one would reference, or this is an example of great Basque writing?
For Basque literature, there are a couple of authors which they completely, you know, they're referent for them, and even linguistically, because they developed or adapted certain words and obviously because there were like many dialects and they kind of like adopted a more homogeneous one. And some of like later writers base their language around the one developed by this particular writer, for example. So there are two or three like that are referenced for them, but within the Basque country, I'm talking in the Basque language, then everybody else, nobody would have heard about them. Do you know what I mean? In the rest of Spain, or at least from the point of view of being in the capital. And then in Spanish language, Basque writers in Spanish language, yes, of course, there are a few. And most recently, there was a book that became very famous and won a prize and everything, which my brother has lent me, but I haven't read yet, which was called Patria, so a homeland. And, well, it's all about the political situation in the Basque country. I think it's between the 80s and nowadays, mostly the 90s, to do with all the political issues with it and so on.
Okay.
Society.
Okay, you trail off there, so that must mean we're coming to the end of part two, perhaps. Anything else you want to share about this topic?
No, I mean, I think there's just I've only started looking at it, you know, and I've probably like missed some important facts, but I don't know, I find it unbelievable, but that we don't know more about it from an out of the Basque country perspective. But then again, it's what happens many times. I don't know, you end up like with a very
skewed,
very like a central narrative, you know, that kind of like diminishes like national identities.
Well, the complaint I heard was that Spain is, you know, made up of different communities, and they all have autonomy relatively to look after their own things, and that means also controlling what is taught in school. So if you're in León, you're learning kind of maybe history related to the north of Spain or to León. If you're in the south, to the south, the Catalans, they learn about Catalan history, especially from a Catalan perspective maybe, and the Basques similarly as well. So even I get the sense that all over Spain, nobody's really learning a unifying history of the country, and rather it's kind of more local things. So the Basques who are going through Basque schools might be aware of this, while us, well, you, I guess, as a Spanish person, not there, would be ignorant of that because of this kind of federalized, or, you know, community.
We wish.
I misspoke there, but you know what I mean? The community driven, where it's separate education models. That doesn't help either, I think, no?
Yes. Yes, but to be honest, I mean, on the one hand, I think for me, what that model is missing is knowing about the other provinces. But I don't want to have that, you know, standardized narrative that applies to all the provinces, because that's always bound to, that's probably the one I got, and that's just bound to, you know, brush over any details as important as the fact that Basque, which is a non-Indo-European language, didn't get written for 1,000 years. I mean, I would have liked to know that earlier in my life.
Well, it's been very interesting to learn about it from you today. So thank you very much for your insights.
Yeah.
And for someone who's not a linguist, you did a hell of a job.
Well, now we can't wait for the comments from the philologists.
Well, it'll probably be in Basque and we won't even be able to understand it anyway.
Probably.
So, well, just one bit of housekeeping. So just 1 second while I look this up. So yeah, before we finish and wrap up part two, and jump gingerly to part three. The Dutch historian I mentioned was Rutger Bregman. You might know him because he went viral at the Davos Economic Forum, where he was complaining that nobody talks about taxation when it comes to dealing with universal basic income. I see you checking your phone, Mary. Well, again, that's a huge topic that we would love to get into on this podcast, but we just don't have time. We respect your time as well, so maybe another podcast we will delve into it. But I think what is very interesting about this guy is, because we've been speaking about history, he's a historian who argues that historians should be a bigger part of the conversation when it comes to the modern world. I think he's very it's very correct, because in Ireland, I know for a fact, and also in other countries, economists have been fetishized, and it's demonstrable that a lot of the advice they've given has been proven to be incorrect. And now we have, you know, great social engagement and movement of people, but historians also aren't part of the conversation yet, and they should be, because when you're talking about universal basic income, and now again, that's a huge issue that you can argue for or against, a historian can say, well, in 1950s America, under Eisenhower, it worked, and there's no reason why it couldn't work again. So I just think it's a fascinating idea, because we're talking about history in this podcast, that the historian could be a subversive figure, a relevant figure, and a person with a unique set of skills that can help shape the modern world for the better. Because, you know, as a historian, if you're advocating for social change or for universal basic income backed up with a historical perspective or facts that support your case, you're not just a historian, but you're also a social advocate and somebody who's taking part in the conversation about how we're going to redefine the contours of our future society, you know, going over the bumps of automation, artificial intelligence, the growth of jobs that are an insult to our dignity. Like, if you're carting around Deliveroo on your back, if you're doing that job, nothing wrong with that, but it's a job where you're probably exploited because these companies are not good. So, well, again, I did just check out his stuff. He also had an interview with Tucker Carlson of Fox News, was also a lunatic, which was pulled from the air, but the Dutch historian recorded it and uploaded it anyway. And whether you end up agreeing with him or not, I think he's a fascinating figure and who has a lot to say about how history can be taken forward into the 21st century. So, well, Mary, thank you so much for your insight in part two. We're going to move now to part three and discuss other things that are also interesting, and then we'll finish talking about those things. So Mary, thank you very much for sharing a shortbread biscuit with me, a cup of Barry's tea, and a debate about the respective merits of Sleepless in Seattle and When Harry Met Sally, both Nora Ephron, Tom Hanks, actually no, Meg Ryan starring classics. Tom Hanks is only in Seattle. And a little trivia, Niles Crane, the guy who plays Frasier's brother, is in that movie very briefly. And he discusses how it always rains in Seattle, which is also an episode of Frasier, because Frasier criticized that on his radio show and people go crazy and almost boycott his radio show. And that's the kind of interesting trivia you can find on IMDb. And here, it will not add anything to your life, but here it is for free. Speaking of movies, I showed you a couple of short movies as well. One about a weighing scale, it's called 72 kg, shot completely on a Samsung phone, because that's what the guy weighs. At the end of the movie. I'm just in this kind of ratchet, this streak of watching short movies after our podcast last week of short movies. Big shout out to our friend of the podcast, Barry Costello. Check out his latest video, which is pretty funny, I have to say. I'll put a link in the description for that. But he actually listened to the last podcast and also gave his opinion about the short documentary that won, I think it's called Period, no? I think that's what it's called.
I think so.
Yeah, of course, yeah. So he was impressed, he thought it was a good movie, but not visually interesting, which is also what I think we said last week about the other short documentaries, yeah. That there were great stories, but weren't pushing the boat out as pieces of aesthetic cinema. Now, this movie about the 72kg... is similar, shot on a Samsung phone, doesn't really capture great textures in the light or the sky, but there are interesting camera angles, and overall the story really carries it along in the same way as Capernaum did last week, as we discussed in that particular podcast. Also, I showed you about AI and something called the LOL bots. So you've just seen this, so this is fresh in your mind. Can you explain what this is?
It's a robot that has been taught how to stand-up comedy.
How to do stand-up comedy.
Because, well, basically I think there's like an algorithm or something that they've input thousands of hours of stand-up comedy, and then there's an algorithm to create new jokes from those jokes.
Yeah, it's deep learning. And it's amazing because this is something that is influencing every area of life. And some people say, well, I'm worried about this, but I've heard another comment saying, well, computers are already too stupid and they run the world. Might as well make them smart. And this can influence everything from your fridge, knowing what you have in it and either telling you it or telling the supermarket, to having personalized banking reports, or if you're a business, having personalized reports, really super detailed. That doesn't sound very exciting, but also, AI can also detect cancer better than a human in certain situations. Also, we can see it in games, in other technology. Also, we mentioned on a previous episode of this podcast, a Netflix documentary called AlphaGo. This is one of the oldest games in the world, and how an AI computer pitted its wits against the best player in the world. But yeah, it was interesting. The jokes were fine. Weren't nothing special, but they're decent.
Better than some routines we've seen.
Exactly. There's another guy, I can't remember his name, but he died of drugs. But he, I'll put the name in the description as well, because he's so funny. Like Bill Burr and all these other comedians would know who he was, but he died before his time. But he just had all these one-liners that were so silly, and he's just amazing. I've just discovered him this week, but I'll put his name in the description, because I can't remember it, like always.
It's going to be a very long description.
I think it will. But it's come to that point in the show when you have to plug Radio Public and describe how our listeners can help us by listening to this podcast on that.
So I'm just going to repeat everything you just said.
Just realized that, yeah.
Yeah, if you listen to, well, you can listen to us on any platform pretty much that you want to, but if you listen to us on Radio Public, you help us a little bit keep doing what we do.
Exactly. And yeah, you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, Patreon, and our blog, irishsliceofmadrid.com. And I think that wraps it up. I think that's everything, really. So we'll be back again next week with another episode of the podcast. And until then, Schlange Fol, Gurav Mahagut. Thank you very much. Ciao. So now it's your turn.
Well, now again, this is Slan. Slan Lat.
Slan Lat. Perfect. All right then. Bye. The Alarpa Podcast, the home for cultural chit chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.
Okay, you can start again, please. So you wouldn't